I'm going to do it, whether you like it or not. It's nothing that bad, though. I can't understand it. No, I want to explain. It's all right. All right. We have a major shear today, but let me catch my breath. I've been working, and I never get everything done, no matter how early I get here. And don't think I'm lazy at home, but there I'm learning, I'm writing, I'm researching. All right, that's life. Again, first of all, today I want to say hello to the wonderful students in front of me. We have here scientists, we have here experts on socks, world famous. We have Rabbanim, and business people, etc., stock market people who are everyone. I went into shul this morning, 5:20 this morning. Chaim Ben-Dor, you hear him on the radio, the television, he gives me hell what Trump has done to the stock market all over the world. He's in charge of all the pension money, I think, for all the medical doctors in Israel. And he shivers and shakes with the darn stock market. I looked at him, I'm a happy guy, but I felt for him this morning. He dobbins next to me, so I can't escape him. He's a great guy. Today I want to say hello to students in front of me, to all those listening across the world. And today's date, that's important too. It's the 24th of December. No other comment necessary. Baruch Hashem, we have no idea about tonight here. That's one of the great advantages of Israel. And I have to say, this year was better than ever. Don't hear a word about Bethlehem and Nazareth, etc. Please be mitpalel for our dear student, Steve Bressler. As I mentioned yesterday, he's in intensive care in Shaarei Tzedek. It seems to be Legionnaire disease after pneumonia. It's serious. Shlomo Zalman Ben Yetta. I just tried to see if there's anything new, but as usual when you're trying, like I'm trying to call Rabbi Finkelstein, I got no answer, so I just left a message. After class, I'll check if there's a message back to me. But God should help and should have a refuah shlema. I just want to mention, last week I made a mistake. And again, these mistakes happen. Rabbi Rubin asked me about Rabbi Yisachar Jacobson. He wrote books. So I said the two Jacobsons, maybe it's one person. Remember, and I said maybe there's a mix-up from his general name to his Hebrew name. There are two Rabbi Jacobsons, both Yekim Tahorim, both born in Hamburg, Germany, both in Chinuch, and both published. And I confused the two. I never knew there were two. I always assumed that they were. This was the Jacobson. So let me just make clear. Rabbi Binyamin Zev Jacobson, who we'll be talking about, we spoke last week, we'll speak again this week, he was more Agudat Yisrael, involved with Beis Yaakov. When he finally came in Aliyah after the Sweden episode, he settled in Yerushalayim. Rabbi Yisachar Jacobson, who Taka published, this is Nativ Binah, this is an English translation, Meditations on the Torah. I own these books. I try to find them. I have no idea if I gave them away, who I gave them to. I always say, a wealthy man is a man who doesn't have to be Makayim the Pasuk of Bir Bistei Acher. That means he has all the books at his disposal. I could have been a wealthy man had I had stock market money to buy a larger apartment. I had a Talmud, the one of the brother, Yossi Klausner. So he inherited, he never married, so money was not a problem. He inherited an apartment from his parents. He was an only child. And he bought a big house, a number of floors in Efrat. The apartment he inherited for his parents was only for books. I think there was something like 12,000 books in that apartment. It's in Talpiyot. So I don't know where they are today, but this is Rabbi Yisachar Jacobson, also born in Hamburg. Yekatahar Mizrachiite, not Aguda. Settled in Tel Aviv, was involved in the Chinuch Mamlachti Dati, so I want to correct myself. Another very interesting fallout from the Shia, we mentioned the word Musulman. So my nephew, Dr. Zev Rothkopf, writes to me, the German, what does Musulman mean? Remember we struggled, what does the word mean? And muscles, Musulman, I know what it means, how, the slang. So Zev writes to me, the German word for Muslim is a Musulman, not related to muscles. Modern Germans probably use a more politically correct term. The other inmates thought these survivors were very thin, and they somehow identified them with Muslims. All right, that's my nephew. My Talmud, and the son of my dear Chava, Nachum Lam, he already says Muslim comes from the German word for Muslim. Apparently, the way camp inmates or survivors moved or acted reminded the Germans of Muslims praying. No one is not quite sure where it came from. Perhaps they were always bent over like Muslims bowing to Mecca, or because they ceased to care about anything like Muslims who believe it's all in the hands of, of Allah, and there's nothing to do. So that's Nachum Lam. So while I was doing research on the Nevadic Yeshiva, and I wound up in the Encyclopedia Judaica to get some point from them, see what they describe, I take a look. Right under Muslim movement is Musulman, German for Muslims, Nazi camp slang for words for prisoners on the edge of death, showing the symptoms of the last stage of hunger, disease, mental indifference, and physical exhaustion. Mostly used at Auschwitz, the term seems to have originated from the typical deportment of sufferers to squat with their legs tucked away in oriental fashion, their faces a mask-like stiffness. So with all that we're saying, you can take your own explanation, but Musulman, Muslim, use slang, survivors, skinny, two-thirds dead, etc. All right? Interesting. Now, if you recall last week, I threw out an article from the New York Times about the President of the United States not eating out in fancy restaurants, and he's a fast food man. Like for us, if we take a lunch, falafel, pizza, my children think pizza is Israeli. It's my grandchildren, it's amazing. They don't know. Do you remember when Richie's opened? What went on? It was a shame. Dove, meet you at Richie's Saturday night, all of Macon Gold and all of BMT, and half of Machel, because they were always a little bit firmer to meet boys. It was always at Richie's. Yitzchak, God, he misses. I just dealt with a question you asked last week, and you were absolutely right, and I was absolutely wrong. You'll pick it up in the tape. Anyway, so remember I said, who took the article? I said, the hund is bagrubben. There's a dog hidden in the article. So Nachum Lam found it right away. What the article says is that who does eat out in the fancy restaurants? The Kushners. No, now you have a different question. I never knew that all the fancy restaurants in Washington are kosher. So I have to be malamed schut. Nachum picked it up right away because he heard me speak about it years ago. When Mrs. Kushner converted, the president's daughter converted, so there was a lot of, I don't want to go into details, the Beitin, the Av Beitin is a very prominent Rosh Yeshiva at Reeds, where you studied, he may have been your Rebbe. So there was a lot of heat on him. And what went on the internet, what he was accused of, it's very sad, you see, because the internet, anyone can say whatever they want. I don't know, can I sue anyone for defamation of character on the internet? I mean, it's very difficult. So he called in the couple, and at the end of 30 days, so Rabbi Lichtstein came with them. Very interesting. And the issues raised were, proper dress, sneered, and eating in treif restaurants. So Rabbi Lichtstein, it's attributed to him that he says, in Kehilat Jeshurun, the women dress properly when they go to shul, but this is the way they dress at fancy occasions. Tzniut is subjective. If you look at the Rambam Hilchot Ishit Perek Tetvav and see the way the Rambam describes a woman's dress, believe me, the firmest people sitting here, I don't want to accuse Morty of anything off the path. His wife is a Stern College graduate. Her father's a Talmud of Reb Aaron Kotler. But your wife and my wife don't dress the way the Rambam describes in Hilchot Ishit. So with the food, what they do, they go talk into the fanciest restaurants, and all the fancy restaurants know this already. Thank God there's so many Jews who observe kashrut. They take salmon and they double wrap it in suva foil. No different when you're on Delta Airline and you ordered kosher food. What's the whole chop? It's double wrapped, okay? So that I'm not advocating. Don't misunderstand me. And then they have vegetables, whatever else, all right, whether they check them with a light table. As wait till Yomo hears what I have to say about the light table next week. He's going to be a little bit upset with the OU, but we'll leave that for next Sunday's class. Finally, I owe Yomo an apology. Yesterday in Shir, he asked a question. I chopped his head off. I took his question literally. He meant figuratively. Then I turned it around, and I said, it's a good question. So after class, he was a little upset with me. You chopped my head off. All right, so I want to tell him a story. Normally, this story would go for 36,000 IOU. But since I want to apologize, it's chinam en kesem. And it's an absolute true story. You all know that I knew Reb Aaron Kotler. I have to say, I knew him Mamish, better than I knew Reb Moshe Feinstein, and I knew both of them and spoke and learned with both of them. And Reb Aaron, there was a great tragedy to his life, because leaving out the personal stories, but he came to America, and Reb Aaron had a fundraising, let me tell you, I'm sitting in this chair only because I refused to become a fundraiser. I was offered a presidency and a Rosh Yeshivaship and this and that, but it all involved administration and fundraising. And I'm a selfish person. I just want to learn and be machadesh, whatever. That's what my life turned into after 1969. So Reb Aaron had to go around schnurring money, and it was very, very difficult. It's like even yesterday, I made a certain proposal to Stephanie Strauss about fundraising for this building, this campus, and right away she said she has to consult with New York. Anything done has to be b'kavod, that it should give Rakefet honor, not turn him into, give me money, please, I plead with you. No, b'kavod. So he had, what would happen was, every month, whatever, they had a schedule, he would have one of the yeshiva boys drive him around, and he goes to this one and that one, and then there's this manufacturer on 7th Avenue, the clothing industry, and the driver takes him, and he goes up with Reb Aaron, he parks the car, and the secretary keeps them waiting. Imagine waiting. And then finally Mr. Big comes out. He, like looks at Reb Aaron like another schnurrer. Like these people come around and shoot. And he gives him a check for $5. So the student later asked Reb Aaron, it's a true story, Rebbe, why do you have to suffer? Why do you have to suffer so much? Why? It's not right. And Reb Aaron says, you don't understand. I'm a Rebbe. I give shiurim. Sometimes the middle of Shia has been upgehitzed. I get excited. And I insult a student. This biyush, this atmet nefesh, is a kapara for when I insult the student. And that's what Reb Aaron answered him. And by the way, this has been published. I heard the story with my own ears. But it's been published, I believe, Nassim Kamenetsky has it in Making of a Gadol. It could be, you'll see it elsewhere. A lot of people wrote about Reb Aaron, Joe Kamenetsky, Amos Funim, etc. Okay, now, so I want to say, I think that explains yesterday, Baruch Hashem. Now, I want to come back to, and also, remember I asked you, how do you pronounce the words in bingo and the umlaut? So, again, let me just find, here he is, Nachum's letter. Nachum has a great deal of knowledge. It's very hard for non-Swedes to pronounce Swedish. For example, a brother of a friend of ours was for a time rabbi of a shul in the city, spelt and pronounced in English, Gothenburg. In Swedish, it's pronounced something like Ejutubudi. So it's best to just pronounce Lindingo as it appears. So we'll stick to Lindingo. Now, I want to come back to the to that camp, to that moment in time, and I want to go further with the memoir literature. It reveals to us the world. All our lectures come down to earth, become real, become tangible. And there's no question that for Rabbi Shlomo Wolpe and for the Jacobson couple, the rabbi and the Rebbetzin, this may have been the greatest moment in their lives. Ein lecha adam shein lo sha'ah. And when I look back in life, as I've told you, God privileged me to be involved with the Mossad. It was there Saturday night. How did you contact the Mossad? I said, you don't contact the Mossad. They contact you. How they got to me, I can't answer you until today. I asked my handler, I asked Aryeh Kroll, Zeichet Tzadik Levracha. I only got double talk. I never got a straight answer. I can only guess that I taught in Mechala, I was in the Israeli scene at the time. Today I'm totally not in the Israeli scene. This is extraterritorial. This is a shtickle of America here, Canada here. But it could be that the word went out, there's this teacher, he's a nice guy, he knows something, he knows how to teach, he has an American citizenship, I have no idea. But there's no question that, as I said to Yitzchak last week, people I sent, not all of them are alive anymore, unfortunately, but some of them told me literally on their deathbed the greatest moments of their lives, the greatest achievements, with the 2.5 weeks they spent in Russia working for the Mossad, working against the communist empire. And there's a lot to be said for that. And here these people were like, how does Rabbi Wolpe, here's a Yekka, how does he wind up in Sweden? This is Rabbi Jacobson, Mrs. Rebbetzin Jacobson. And here's another girl speaking, and this is very important. She speaks about Rabbi Jacobson, she speaks about Shabbos, and she talks about her first Shabbos in Lindingo. At last, the tall figure of Rabbi Jacobson entered and stood at the head of the table where he delivered a Devar Torah interlaced with allusions to the events of the week. Mein liebe Kinder, my beloved children, he began. These weren't shallow words, empty of meaning. Listen to this now. He treated us as if we were his own children, and perhaps even more than that, because he and his wife had left their own children in Stockholm for our sake. They were under the care of a devoted housekeeper, but that doesn't compare to a mother or father. And here what you've touched upon is one of the most difficult questions that every machanech, every rav faces. Unfortunately, if you do a survey, you'll see that the percentage of rebellion among rabbis' children, machanchim's children, is probably larger than the population at large. And here I'll tell you a story. Maskinish kachat, absolutely true. These ears, don't have to cite anyone else, but I experienced it. The founder of Torah in America was a person named Rabbi Dr. Dov or Bernard Revel. All of you know the story of Rabbi Revel. Here's a man, ran away from Europe, came over in 1906, and what that man accomplished, against all odds, we take for granted, Talmudical Academy, Yeshiva College, reorganization of Ritz, one man, and he turned the soil. He married the right lady, Sarah Travis Tzadekit, raised in Marietta, Ohio, from a well-to-do family at the time, and enabled him not to take a salary from the yeshiva. He didn't take a salary till 1922, when her family started having difficulties with Standard Oil, and they started losing money. Ultimately, there was a sort of a bankruptcy, etc. But what this man accomplished. Now, they had two sons. Mrs. Revel told me, again, generally speaking, when people have one child or two children, it means physically they had problems. She said she couldn't have any more. She always regretted it. I can understand that. A woman who doesn't have a daughter, she's lacking. She's missing. But she had two sons, Norman and Hirschel. Norman was born, if my memory is correct, 1910. Hirschel was born 1912. And these children never married. And Norman once yelled at his father in a fit of anger, "You had time for everybody else's child, but not your own." And I have to tell you, this is a real life scenario. My youngest daughter still doesn't forgive me for schlepping her to BMT with all the boys for the Pesach Seder in 1970, 71. You got to remember, in those years, no one went home. It's not like today that everyone goes back and forth and forth and back. Then you came for the year. There was no telephone to telephone America. You had to make an appointment to go to the central post office on Rehov Yafa. 2 o'clock in the morning, you would have a line to the United States for 5 minutes. It was a different world. And this, you got to give all the credit in the world to the Jacobsons, that here they left their family. And I don't know if it's right or wrong. I'll give you another example in a minute. Left their family, left the children in Stockholm. My housekeeper, who was a Shomer at Shabbos, and you had to help them make a Shabbos to be with these poor children who survived the Holocaust in Lindingo. And Charlie, what does this remind you of? You and I, Morty, Rav Shach, the Gadol Hadar, the great Gadol Hadar, the Panovich of Rosh Yeshiva. No, could you imagine? His son turns out a classmate of Arnie Rothkopf in Bernard Revel Graduate School. That Baruch Hashem wasn't as good as you think, because the generation beyond, let me not say something recorded. I knew, and Rav Shach suffered, and ear witnesses say that Rav Shach said, "The greatest mistake I made was leaving my wife," and he couldn't take the family to Panovich. In other words, when I went away to Machon Gold for Shabbos, I took my family. Can anyone tell me why he couldn't take the waiter family to Panovich, Simon, for Shabbos? Because his wife, he pulled his wife Ruth, Rabisa Zalman Meltzer's niece, Rabisa Zalman Meltzer made the shidduch, his best Talmud, his niece, she was in medical school in Moscow. She was like a doctor. She was a brilliant woman. So she assisted. There was a Gentile doctor who took care of the Jews, and a Chassid Umat Olam, who took care of the Jews in Geula, in the Yeshiva Yashan, in Meir Shalom, that area. On Shabbos, she had to be there. She was the focal point. If anyone had a problem, they came to her. And if it was a real problem, she brought the doctor in. If not, she took care of it. So she couldn't leave. And he always said, "It was a terrible mistake. Instead of being at home with my children and singing smiris with them, he was in Panovich Shabbos." Okay? Check this out. See if they mention it in the biographies of him. And this is a point worth thinking about. But to the Jacobsons' credit, they were with the children on Shabbos. And Rebbetzin Jacobson, and she's a very impressive figure here, knew how to devote special study sessions to topical issues so they would have a greater impact on us. On Erev Yom Kippur, for example, between the afternoon meal and the Suda HaMapseket, we would study the portions on the service of the Kohen Gadol. When after such a lesson, when the Chazan recited, "And the entire community of Israel shall be forgiven, for the entire nation is in error," I felt there were no sinners, and that no one was angry at his fellow Jew, because we were all righteous. The words of Rabbi Elimelech of Lizhansk, "May we be privileged to see the virtues of our fellow and not his faults," became an integral part of me at such times. And here too, it's a very moving description, and there's a lot to be said. You talk about the Avodah on Yom Kippur. You go to Shul, the Chazan is going through Musaf, everyone's looking at their watch, they way to want to have a good break, and you come to the Avodah. How much, when you fall Korim, Shechaviti, Shechachati, Shechashati, Echad, Echad V'Echad, how much Kavanah do you put in it? And here, look what this Rebbetzin was able to accomplish. And like this takes us back to the Rav. Yitzchak, you remember the Tshuva Drashet, where the Rav describes Reb Chaim during the Avoda, and the Rav says, and here what he's saying, I don't know if the Rav knew, Siddiq Rabbeim said the same thing, that he felt that Reb Chaim was back in the Beis HaMikdash. And when he felt Korim, he was hearing the Kohanim say, Tshem HaMeforesh, and the Baruch Shem Kavod Malchuto was literally feeling that he's in the Beit HaMikdash. And I have to tell you, Hasidic Rebbeim, they say, and some Rebbeim, when they felt Korim, and Kach Hayiti Omer, that the Rebbe felt himself that he was the Kohen Gadol in the Beit HaMikdash. But you see, this is a challenge, not just upzugging the Vetter to say the words, it's a challenge to daven and feel, to relive, to recapture. This is the greatness of davening, the greatness of being a Jew, that time is not a factor for us. We're an eternal community. It's the Rav used to say, Kehilah al nitzchit b'yivrit meduberet. The Hebrew we use today, that's the term that they would use to translate the Rav, and it's a very important factor. I always feel there are two messages. I was interviewed, I said, again, when that article what's it called, Ignite, from my words to what was published, there's a large vacuum, I'll say, a large chasm. But I said, how do you make kids from, how do you achieve? And I said, there are two messages. If we can get these messages over, we will succeed. One is what we've already spoken about, that we're very different than Obama, we're very different than Trump, we're very different than the non-Jewish world, because we have a dual existence, as individuals, of course, but as members of the Jewish community, the Kehillah, the Eidah, etc. The other message is, everyone else lives for the moment. The New York Times lives for the moment. We live within the scope of eternity. For us, our Avot, Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, are just as real as our teachers in school. And Mashiach Tzidkenu is just as real as the principal of the school we go to. And that's a very important message. If you understand that, your whole life, your whole gestalt takes on a different tinge, a different world outlook. Now, here is very interesting, and again, it's hard to know who these people are. Obviously, probably the overwhelming majority no longer alive. We're talking about people who survived the Holocaust. So it means at the youngest, they have to be my age or slightly older. The youngest girls, let's say they were 5 or 6, 7. And at my age already, when I look at my smicha picture, I say to Malkin, half the guys are gone. She said, well, what do you want? What's your age? I said, what's my age? I'm 24. What's going on? Yeah, it depends when. So here it's C. Breuer. So, Charlie, you understand what I'd like to know, if this is any relation to the elegant Breuer family. But here, again, each memoir has something special. Only yesterday I was in a German concentration camp with SS soldiers with murderous expressions on their faces surrounded us, posted on every watchtower and along the entire length of the electrified fence. It seemed I had lived in this world for months, years, perhaps all my life. Was there another world other than one composed of rotten potato peels and a single hard board shared by several prisoners crowded together at night? And you know, you come out, remember what you've gone through. And I still remember when I came out of communist Russia the first time, and I reached Israel, I danced the Kazatska at the airport. You know, and there was a student, Yaakov Shechatovitz. Yaakov is a brother to the Rebbetzin who died. Okay, I taught many members of that family. So Yaakov was in BMT in 81, and these kids grew up in my house in the 60s. We were very close. I was the rabbi in Maplewood, South Orange, and their father was the principal of the day school in Newark. You understand? So it was more than a student. It's like a son. You know. So he came to my house, and we were driving to BMT together, and we stopped at the light in Nayot, turning into Kvish Bazak, and I started to sing, and he said, "What, Rebbe, what are you singing for?" I said, "You don't know where I was last week. You don't understand what it means to be free, to be home, not to look over your shoulder and hear these people come out, and they have to go back to a normal world." And she describes, and this theme comes up all the time, how good the Swedish people were. Not only good, they were kind, they were considerate. And they didn't mean any harm, but they would have loved to adopt these children, raise them as non-Jews. And here, after a few weeks in Sweden, recuperating, they finally have the guts to ask these Swedish non-Jews, "Are there Jews in Sweden too?" And then she says how these non-Jews got in touch with the Swedish Jewish community, and they came to visit them. And listen to what this girl says. "However, I wasn't familiar with Jews of that type. They conversed in Swedish, were clean-shaven, and wore no head covering, didn't wear kippah, the women didn't cover their hair. To someone like me, coming from a sheltered Hasidic background, they seemed strange and different, and I was very confused. Nevertheless, the kindness and goodwill of these assimilated Jews made us feel much better." And here too, you see, you come into that conflict. Could you imagine if the World War II, the survivors reach America? And here you have the most famous rabbis. Let's take New York City. Rabbi Lookstein. Did he have a beard? Go to Brooklyn. Rabbi Wahlberg. Did he have a beard? Rabbi Turk. Did he have a beard? Rabbi Berezon. Did he have a beard? These were the top rabbanim. You understand? And these people were frum and fabulous speakers. And here, you're looking at them. You understand the conflict. It's like sometimes I remember at the Koto, people would come over to me and introduce their, "This is a Rav Rakeya." And I would tell them, "Calm down, these kids can't even understand. This is a Rav Rakeya without a beard, without etc. All that has to go with the Rabbanut. This is a nice Jew who davens at the Koto. Someday they'll study with me, then they can reach their own conclusions. But now," and these beautiful description. Then she goes on how one Christian woman took a liking to her, and this woman was so anxious to adopt her. And she promised this girl that, "We will give you kol tov, what we say, kol tov Mitzrayim." It's a temptation. How many Jews were adopted? How many Jews became Christians? How many Jews never came back? In Poland today, do you have any idea how many Jews remain Christians, their children today? We're talking, the figure must be well over tens of thousands. Well over tens of thousands, you know, with descendants. All right, there's a reawakening, Jewish culture, a kumsitz, what do they call these bands, the Jewish bands, what do they call it? The klezmer. They have to have a klezmer affair there. The overwhelming majority who come are not even Jewish. They go to church on Sunday. But they have Jewish roots, but this girl was strong. Then, here's the description, it's beautiful. It was announced in the camp where she was in Sweden, that a Rav would deliver a lecture. I didn't know his name. At the appointed time, I went with a number of friends to the dining room in order to listen to the Rav's speech. At last he arrived. As he walked into the front of the room, I thought, "Ribbono shel Olam, is it possible that there are still such people in your world?" I looked at his noble bearing, at his long black beard. I saw eyes that sparkled with vitality and Ahavat Israel. Then I thought, this is the first genuine Jew I have encountered after all these years of suffering and torture. Something seeing him reminded me of my hometown, of the environment I had known as a child, and all that had been dear to me. That was how the Jews I had known looked, and I had yearned and prayed to see such a person once more. So you see, you can't put a price on this memoir literature. This is a young lady speaking who went through a hell of hells. Remember, never forget what I told you, with the shul I grew up in, with the man who came three times a day, and rumor had it, whenever his wife cooked chicken soup, she added milk to it. And I remember I went to the rabbi, an itinerant rabbi. We had rabbanim, there were survivors, one, the two, they went on, they conquered America. And I said to him, we should say something. She puts milk into the chicken soup. And I'll not forget his answer. You can't say anything. What they experienced, you can't start to understand. And that was a powerful answer, powerful insight.
Does she write what language the Swedish rabbis
spoke? No, she doesn't write what language, but I would imagine it was Yiddish. It was not Swedish rabbi, it's Rabbi Jacobson, a German rabbi who happens to find himself in Sweden with, you know, what I gave you his biography last week. And the Reb spoke about Shabbos and Kashrut, and he told us about the school for girls who had survived the Holocaust that he had organized, and he invited us to join them. And she goes on to Lindingo, and she says, everything I am today, I am because of the Rav and the Rebbetzin. And halavai, we would know who she was, how many children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, great-great-grandchildren, out of this woman, out of this rabbi and Rebbetzin, who bring her in with warmth, there can be today 500 Jews walking the face of the earth. Now there's another girl, A. Flintstein, and she quotes the Rebbetzin, listen, dear girls, to what our sages say, a malek jumped into the bath and cooled it. Yes, dear girls, the Amalek of our generation cooled our hearts. These were the words of our beloved Rebbetzin Jacobson. And she describes, when she heard these words, she understood that there was a great challenge to her with all that she had gone through, not to allow her heart to be killed. Can she rekindle it? And she says, I met a glowing personality who spread healing light. He confronted a room full of frozen souls whose spark the Nazis had nearly extinguished, even though they had not killed their bodies. And as if he wielded a magic wand, the warmth of his pure heart, which burned with love for the downcast, slowly instilled spirit into the embers, saved from the flame. That man was Rav Binyamin Zev Jacobson. So you see, time and again, this theme comes through. And here, this poor girl afterwards is hunted. And now, many, many survivors in the memoir literature, what I'm about to quote, comes up time and time again. Excuse me. Why did I survive? All my family was wiped out. Who am I? Am I more of a tzaddik? Am I more of a saint? And this poor girl is suffering, and she keeps a lit Yahrzeit candle in her room. It's like a memory of her family, that she survived. She doesn't understand why. She was not the frumest, the best, the finest. So many tzaddikim, tzidkaniyot. Why? And you see this time and again. And some people never got over it. They remained hospitalized, they remained institutionalized till the time of their death. reparations money. A good deal of it went in Israel to help these people who were institutionalized. But this girl, she keeps the Yahrzeit candle. By chance, Rabbi Jacobson, discovered the Yahrzeit candle in her room. And he said to her, "No, this is not the way to memorialize those who died, your family. You have to keep on learning. You have to keep on studying. Better than a candle, study for the elevation of their souls." And that's a beautiful thought, to be positive, to go further, to learn. And, all right, I'm caught up with that thinking. I need not tell you, I see a Litvisha trend here. I told you, my mother's Yahrzeit, I always make, God should privilege me to always be able to make a siyum. And to me, I hate to say it, that's more important than the Kaddish and davening for the Yomit and the Kel Mole. All right, you do it, fine. But the siyum and learning and going further and freshness, this is study for the elevation of their souls, is what Rav Jacobson taught me. Now, the next paragraph is also very moving to me, and here I don't want to go into details because it can embarrass people. But you see, it's not enough spiritual and all that we do. More important is first the physical needs. If you don't take care of the physical needs, everything else basically is secondary. Now, one of the great problems we have, people who go through concentration camps, people who are in jail, when they come out, their teeth. Have you ever thought about that? I was at my nephew, the dentist, and someone walks in who I see is familiar to me. And he asks me, and he knew who I was. And I can't exactly place him, and he asked me about the dentist, is he good? You know, and I only realized in retrospect who that was. He had just gotten out of jail. It's a story that we need not talk about. A shanda for Yeshiva University, but what can we do? People are people. You can have smicha and have a doctorate, and you can still be, as we know, a maneuver to the second power, the third power. And in jail, the dental care doesn't compare to what you can do outside. So I asked my nephew afterwards. My nephew said to me, "Yeah, I helped him. I did a tremendous job, but I didn't want to think about why he sat so many years in the Chad Gacha." So you should know, people came out of Russia, people who were jailed. So there was one case, a person, a refusenik in jail, he needed such extensive dental work, and it was what the government would give him would only cover part of it. And you have to help out, you have to do. And Baruch Hashem, a Talmud helped me, and we were able to do wonders. And here, in this paragraph, she says that Rabbi Jacobson also noticed my teeth, nearly all of which had decayed in the ghettos and the camp. Despite the desperate financial situation of our school and the high cost of dental care, he did not rest until he had arranged the dental treatment for me. And see, this is a tremendous compliment. The line that comes next brings me to another story. He also saw I didn't have a winter coat, and with great effort, he found a warm winter coat for me. Now, what story does this remind you of that was in every Israeli newspaper? Rav Shach, what's the story? And I have to tell you, you all know from over the years that I have a lot of warmth for Rav Shach. There's a lot to admire. I'm all right, politically and hashkafic-wise. He attacked my Rebbe on Yosef Yechav. He's enabled me to make a living. I've given many lectures on Rav Shach's critique of Mori Rebbe's Chamesh Drashot and why. And I know Rav Shach's son, but the grandchildren, etc. I get the entire picture. But Rav Shach, when it came to learning, let's be positive, that we don't have to be negative. We are all right, we have differences of opinion, but in the Gemara, if you know Masechet Ediyot, Beit Shammai, Beit Hillel had many differences of opinion, but they still intermarried, right or wrong, and they still ate in each other's home. It's an open Mishnah, Masechet Ediyot. So there was a funeral in Bnei Brak, an old lady died, and Rav Shach went to the funeral, and the people were going crazy. What does Rav Shach have to do with this funeral? What is he leaving the base? What, leaving his Talmidim, leaving his learning? You remember the story? And Rav Shach was interviewed. Was hat der Rosh Yeshiva as ich makriach given? Why did the Rosh Yeshiva? How do you say it in English? Matriach given. I'm forgetting my English. It's okay. You get the word. You get the message. Well, what's this lady to you? And he told the story. When he ran away to Slutsk and was learning in the Beis Medrash in the city, and it was World War I, and there was no way to go home again, he didn't have a coat. You know how cold the winters are in Russia? I functioned in 40 below zero. I was a young man and I couldn't today, I'll tell you that. But wow, 30 below zero. I remember boarding the plane in London to fly to Moscow in 85. So they announced that the temperature in Moscow is 25 degrees below zero. And Malk and I looked at each other. We were lucky when we could reach Riga, it was 40 below zero. And this woman gave Rav Shach, a poor woman, how she came up with the money she collected, she did, gave him a warm winter coat. And that coat lasted for years, saved his life, and he never forgot it. And this is the story here with Rabbi Jacobson, the warm winter coat. And the article goes on, what they did, how Makir Toiva, what they got from the couple, what they got in this little school in Sweden, of all places, before they go on Aliyah. Okay? So that's Breuer. Here, Rivka Levy. And here too, I just quote from her memoir, this is worth quoting, we spent Pesach in Bergen-Belsen in 1945 with neither chametz nor matzah, but with a lot of mara. You follow? And here too, I quote Rakefet to you. It's an interesting thought. I believe I heard it from the Rav. Others tell me I heard it from Israel Solanta. It could be I heard it from both, that the Rav heard it from the Musaniks, and he repeated it. But it's a meritic thought. The Seder, what bracha do you make? First you make a motzi, then you make mara, right or wrong? Tell me, which came first? The mara came before the matzah. The mara was Egypt. The order is wrong. The chronology is wrong. But the Rav said, the Balei Musa say, in a fabulous part, that if we would only think of the mara, we can't go further in life. It's a healthy defense mechanism to stress the good and to forget the bad. That enables us to go further. Say tonight, Chazal understood. First be happy with the matzah, with the deliverance, with the liberation. Afterwards, all right, you're happy? Now we want you to go back and remember what you went through. And it's a good word, she says. We didn't have chametz or matzah, but we had plenty of mara. And she describes how sick, how ill she was. And they tell them they're taking all these girls to Sweden. They're going to recuperate there. She describes this the first time she was on a boat, the first time she saw a sea. And here she is in a sanitarium in Storbruk in Sweden. Everything is beautiful, food, clothing, medical care, but absolutely no Yiddishkeit. And here, the girls, what are they going to do? These girls come from religious backgrounds, and they're very, very upset. And in this atmosphere, a relative visits her and tells her about Mundingo, where lessons are given in Yiddish and in Hebrew. How will I manage there, I asked. I don't know either language. Nevertheless, my relative persuaded me, go, see, you'll fit in. And she travels with another girl, Rachel Weinberger, to Stockholm, and here they come into Rav Jacobson's home, and he warmly says to them, ah, so you are Rivka, you are Rivka. He stressed the Rivka, and I heard and understood, Rivka, not Rosa. And these are beautiful psychological thought. You come back to your people. I gave up Arnold. No one even knows my name is Arnold. I went to school for so many years. Everyone knew me as Arnie. The Rav called me Arnold. My name was Arnold. Arnold, all right. Today I pull shtick. Chaim Maltz, Herbie Maltz wants to be called Chaim. I hit him over the head. The Ramban in Pashat Bo, HaChodesh Hazeh Lechem Rosh Chodashim. All right, you all know the Ramban, the Chatam Sofer, gave entire drushit based upon that Ramban. Why do we have Gaiusha names, Chaldean names, Babylonian names? Why can't we call the months Ziv, Hebrew names, to remember where you came from? Tchila of Dei Avodah Zarah Hayu Avotenu. All right, there's something to be said by recalling that you were once named Donald Edward, not Aaron Yitzchak. On the other hand, here's this girl who's gone through hell, and now she's Rivka. She's no longer Rosa. And she describes the learning, how the Rav and the Rebbetzin was so thoughtful, understood where they're coming from, what they went through. And she gives one example here. All right? And this example here, imagine, I hope Artsko would not leave this out, and if they published, would not censor it. Here, the staff never reproved us directly. In other words, these girls, 2 years they hadn't learned. Who knows how young they were? Who knows what they knew? Maybe they were making mistakes on Shabbos and Kashrut. Instead, they gradually raised us from level to level, each according to our ability. And she gives this illustration. The administration knew how much we longed for letters. And when the letters arrived on Shabbat, they had a non-Jew open them so we could read our letters immediately. New Doves, do research. If you're allowed, a non-Jew, open, read the letter, muksa, chutzlatchum. But you see, they were sensitive. What these girls have gone through, let us do everything possible to help them. Even if perhaps you can quibble that there's a niece of the Rabbanin involved, there's a niece Shail of Muktza. No, at this level in life, open up and let them enjoy the letters. And then she describes the final days when the State of Israel is declared. The gates are open, and the final Mariv, and Rav Jacobson, who remains behind in Lendingo. Why did he remain behind for another number of months? Because there were girls who were going to relatives in America, and that took more time. But the girls going to Israel, now they could all go together and go at once. And he ends off his talk after Mariv, Baruch Atah B'Vo'acha, Baruch Atah B'Tzeitecha. And she describes how they arrived during the War of Independence. They wind up in Binyamina, and who comes out to help them adjust to Israel? Rav Shlomo Wolpe. Their teacher who had taught them in Lendingo was already in Israel, and he brought them, helped them, look up at the blue skies of a sacred land, and when the heart is filled with their beauty, no room will remain inside for worries or troublesome thoughts. And they go on to the Beit Chalutzot in Haifa, and she describes, compared to Sweden, there was no electricity, a number of other small things were missing. It was hard to get used to the hot climate after a much colder climate, but nevertheless, with uplifted spirits and the feeling that we had found a home, we clustered around Rebbetzin Jacobson. She would teach us and read the amusing letters her husband sent from Sweden. A few months later, Rav Jacobson arrived. He didn't tell us he was coming because he wanted to surprise us. We were overjoyed that he finally joined our family circle. And all the memoir literature, ultimately, one by one, the girls married. Remember, Rivka Grzynski marries Rav Shlomo Wolpe. One by one, they married. Majority moved to Yerushalayim, but they all remained in touch with each other. Now, Nachum Lem says, a few years ago, he thinks a book was written about Mdingo. I wonder if it isn't the book I'm quoting from. Okay, if Nachum is listening, see if you can find out the book. All right, let me go one... Excuse me?
Put in the school's name in Google.
So do it and let's see what you come up with. I may have done it already. I don't know. I played with the computer to get information on Jacobson's. I may have done it, but besides...
The amazing thing is, I'm really appreciative of what you've been doing because I only know Jacobson from the Svarim, Nativ Bina...
Right, but that's only, that's not him.
Are you sure?
You'll hear the first part of the shiur. While
B.Z. Jacobson.
Look at the first part of the shiur. You'll hear. There's Zelichud v'Zelichud. They're both from Hamburg. They're both Yekkers. They both come to Israel. But they're not the same. But one is a Mizrachite. One is an Agudist. This one is Aguda. The other one is Mizrachi. He lived in Tel Aviv, the Mizrachi.
He came to Israel. He taught the girls about love for Eretz Israel.
Yeah, no, this, what do you think, Aguda doesn't have love for Eretz Yisrael? Don't let the politicians give you a false impression, and don't let the newspapers, there are brothers, they're the one, there's no difference between us and what's happening here in Eretz Yisrael. I mentioned yesterday that, yes, we want to turn them into Israelis, Haredi Israelis. Think what I said yesterday, it's very, very true. Look at the newspapers. Look at Yisrael Hayom, a Friday, 2/3 of the articles about Jews with beard, payas, Haredim, Israelis, 100%. All right, leave it for another time. I want to show you something else here. In the next interview, the next lady, Bluma Ries, okay? And she tells a story that they survive, they wind up in a we'll call it a halfway house, yet in Germany before they go on to Sweden. And she's in the hospital, and she's put on a special diet to revive us. At that time, I weighed about 30 kilos, 65 pounds. Look what happens in life. This is funny. A clueless but well-meaning Australian doctor asked me if I had always been so thin. Okay? Two relatives of mine who had known me before the war in the same room, they burst out laughing at the doctor's question. They recalled that I once had been quite chubby. And when they reached Sweden, she describes how every evening we would secretly remove bread, cookies, and other food from the table and take it to our rooms. When the administration learned about this, they saw these kids were hungry at night. From that time on, they gave them an additional meal before they went to sleep. Right? These were goyim chassidei umat olam. And then the problem with kashrut, and she describes when she comes to Lindingo, she describes the cook, Tante Schengel, the cook, a very special woman, is indescribable. Tante Schendel, for example, always recalled that I liked the head of the fish on Shabbos and saved one for me every week. And the feeling, the spirit, but again, these people are haunted. I recall one Friday night when everyone else was dancing and singing while I sat in the corner and cried, I can't forget how Rav Wolpe didn't leave my side until I agreed to join the circle of dancing girls. A year later, my uncle and aunt, the Jungreises, this is Rebbetzin Jungreis, right? What was her first name, the Rebbetzin?
Esther.
Esther Jungreis, right or wrong? This is the family. It's a Hungarian family. I know and Esther and her brother Binyamin, we all knew each other from Bnei Akiva. They secured a certificate, and she was able to go to Eretz Yisrael even before it became Medinat Yisrael. This is under the British. Parting from Lindingo was an emotional-filled experience. Shendel, the cook, packed food for me because there was no kosher food on the ship which I was about to sail on. And you see this love, the feeling, here the people that survived the nightmare and Lindingo, hard to leave. A halfway house in their life, but a halfway house that saved their life. And here's another memoir, Rebbetzin Kette Jacobson, the name Kette, K-E-T-T-E. Charlie, help me out. Is that a German name? You don't recognize it either. Could be Jette. Kette with a K. And she writes here, when she met Kette the first time, she was apprehensive to approach her because her native language was German. And here they were coming from the concentration camps, the death camps, where they, every time they hate German, they hated it. And here, this was the Rebbetzin's native language. But what a lady she is. She describes from Shlomo Wolpe what these people did for them, how they saved them. Otherwise, there could have been total assimilation in Sweden. So this is a magnificent chapter in Vad Hatzala history. Vad Hatzala played a role. They helped support it. And this opens our eyes to what people were able to accomplish, our fellow Jews, at a moment of such challenge and tribulation, and to save so many lives, create so many homes. And it takes us back to Rav Lazer Silva, $100,000, and all the money he gave out, whatever he gave out to survivors, for reasons, this, that, the other reason, but on condition, they remarry and start all over again. And if not for that, many of us would not be sitting here. The Jewish people would be so weakened today. And Baruch Hashem, 70 years ago, people of vision and foresight. Now, two more books I want to mention, and well reading both of them. One of them, you've all heard the name Irvin Bunim, A Fire in His Soul. Once again, I'm privileged to tell you I knew Irvin Bunim personally, and I certainly knew his son who wrote this book, Amos Bunim, Amos Bunim, Amos Bunim. Unfortunately, they're both gone. Amos died young. He has two sisters that are still alive. One of them lives right across the street from Rabbi Reuben, right or wrong. Okay, Hannah Orsabel, originally Hannah Bunim, then Hannah Reuben, then Hannah Pupko, Hannah Orsabel, at Sadekit Yesod Olam. And Dov, I don't use those words indiscriminately. And Amos Bunim wrote a biography of his father. It's a very good biography, even though it's written by a son. And whenever you see a biography, for instance, if I wanted to write a biography of Bernard Rebel today, Jack, they would not allow me to. Why wouldn't I be allowed? No, tell me. Because I'm related, it's my cousin. If a cousin can't write about a cousin, I found that out now. I didn't know it 60 years ago. If a cousin can't write about a cousin, Allah had come of a comma, a son can't write about a father. But it's a beautiful biography, a memoir, and scholarly. It's quite balanced. Now, Irvin Bunim was a very interesting individual. He was a successful individual in the textile business. And he was a man who, I don't know if he was born in America, but certainly came to America at a young age and remained from in America and was one of the leading balabatim on the Torah scene. And beginning on page 163, they describe some of the Hatzalah activities after World War II. And here, they describe how many Jews were left in every country. And in Sweden, you had 18,000 Jews. The Hatzalah representative, as I mentioned, who traveled there and gave them information, was, of course, Rabbi Vogelanter. And one of the biggest problems they faced in all these camps and all these configurations, kosher food. Gentiles could be wonderful, could help, could clothe, could feed, give beds, but the concept of kosher food didn't exist for them. For Sweden alone, the VAT spent 1946 money, $10,000 a month, just to supply kosher food for the survivors. The VAD would send packages all over Europe, including Sweden, for Pesach. Over 100,000 pounds were sent. They supplied virtually all the matzot for Italy, Italy's 5,500 survivors. It shipped thousands of cases of dried food from Switzerland and 60,000 parcels of food, clothing, and religious articles from Tehran. A bottle of saccharin, which cost the VAD 60 cents, could be exchanged for 70 pounds of bread, enough to keep two people alive for 2 months. And what does this remind you of? Do you remember what went on with Russian Jewry? The RCA, Rabbi Kowalski, the packages that were sent? Do you have any idea how helpful those packages were? And also the concept of what can be sold on the black market. And there I can tell you, with the Mossad and the whole operation, many times the people we were sending would bring in sophisticated cameras. A tourist is allowed to have a camera. That camera you would pass on, sold on the black market. It would bring in, for instance, I brought in a camera in 1985, very beautiful camera. I didn't know the first thing about how to use it. I was worried stiff if they questioned me. But my wife, in the new book, you'll see what my wife did to the KGB. They never saw that camera. Kol hakavod la to Malka. And they sold that camera on the black market. It sustained the study circles in Moscow, the Machanayim group, for one full year. That's how much money you would get on the black market. And then they did what they had to do. In other words, the money was used for photography. I think I explained to you. You couldn't use Xerox machines. They were government controlled. The government knew every page what you were doing with it. But photography, if you took a picture and you had a dark room, you took a picture of a Daf Gemara. No, in your dark room, you produced 1,000 copies of it. No one knew what you were doing. There was no control. But all that cost money. That's what came out of the camera. That's exactly what they're doing here. Now, there's a beautiful story on page 164. And this story actually happened to me in Australia. I couldn't believe it when I read the story, because B'didi Haviyovna. Here's the story from 164. In April 1945, Rechish Sternberg, that was the big activist from Switzerland, the Sternbuch family, all the credit in the world, called Bunim for help. She was dealing with the War Refugee Board. The survivors are coming out, and they can't get kosher food in. And the Gentile woman in charge doesn't want to help. She says, food is food. What's the difference? She has no concept of kosher food. And she's pleading with Erwin Bunim, do something. Have the American government contact her. And Bunim goes on to tell the story with the Red Cross, etc. And finally, they're now dealing with the United Nations Relief Organization. And a Gentile official asks the lady, why do you need special kosher food? And she explains, these people are very religious. If they eat food that's not kosher, they'll get sick. And the man from Yunra, the guy, says, oh, it's like in the book of Daniel. It was a miracle. And this man remembered, he knew the Bible, that Daniel only ate special kosher food in captivity. That's right, I said. We had no trouble after that. Kosher food, they understood. These Jews, only kosher food. And this is a little story about a Hasid Matolama guy. No, what did I say about Australia? Here I arrive in Australia. And there, when you come in, they go through what you're bringing. They want to be sure there's no vegetables. And, you know, they pretty strict customs. And they want to know if you have money, what you're going to do. You know, I had no problem. Because I told him, well, I don't even know where I'm going, I said. But I'm invited by the synagogue. I'm a rabbi, a professor. And they're waiting for, you're a rabbi? And this Australian customs official, 6'6", tall, they're very tall there, handsome. He says, Rabbi, I was waiting for you. I have a question. I look at this guy, and you know what he asked me? He said, Rabbi, did they bring sacrifices during the period that they were in the desert? I say, yes, God commanded. I don't know. Did they? Yeah, why not? He says, where did they get the meal offering? I said, well, from the manna. He starts dancing. He says, Rabbi, that's what I said to my father at the study group when they asked this question. It had to be from the manna. He said, oh, Rabbi, it's a pleasure. He said, please take everything and meet your people. God should bless you.
Sure, that's the right answer.
I don't know if it's the right answer. What do you want out of me? But it was the right answer at that moment in time, you understand? And here, the story with this guy, he remembers the book of Daniel. Beautiful. And finally, I want to introduce you to one more volume. And again, very, very worthwhile reading. The trouble is, this volume came out quite late. You see, Dr. Zuroff, Ephraim Zuroff, Effie Zuroff, his volume on Bat Hatzalah got a lot of publicity. And it's an interesting volume. When I was in Australia, I remember they were furious, you know, with him. They wanted to know my opinion. What was the story? I think I told you. Because he writes about Shanghai, that the Bat Hatzalah favored the Mir Yeshiva. And I spoke about it months ago, that look, when you give stuff, you have a right to give. At that time, no one knew every Jew was going to be killed. They thought they were suffering. I have a right to help the Yeshiva people. And I remember the Rebbetzin, her husband is gone already, but Rebbetzin Cohn, Shoshana, I believe her name, so she said to me, do you know where I was born? I said, yeah, you were born in Shanghai. She said, you're right, I was born in Shanghai. You know where I slept? In a carton under my parents' bed. That Mir got more than everyone else. See, they were furious with Effie Zuroff. But Effie Zuroff, a little bit, he has it. You know, he's a little bit upset with the Haredi world at that time. Today it's a little bit better. It's the old story, the army and all that goes with it. So this volume, Battling for Souls, is not about the Bat Hatzalah before and during World War II. It's about the Bat Hatzalah Rescue Committee in post-war Europe. And there's a world of information here. Now, the author is Alex Grubman, Grubman. The book is dedicated to Rabbi Nathan Baruch. Now let me say a few words about Rabbi Nathan Baruch. Well worth recalling this gentleman. He was born in Poland in 1924, came to the United States with his parents and 8 siblings when he was 5 years old. They lived on the Lower East Side. He went to high school at Mesifta Torah Bedas. Later he gets smicha, and does have income. He was a part-time rabbi, had a little shteller in Spring Valley. See, hard for us to understand, Spring Valley was the start of what today is Muncie. I remember this. I don't know how many others remember it. Spring Valley was a little shtetl there. There were a number of Jews. For whatever the reasons, there was an Orthodox shul there. Who would ever dream what would come out of Spring Valley? When Torah Vadas opened what probably was the first kollel in America, Beis Medrash Egel, although the Rav had a kollel in Boston, but that ended. It was only a few years, because when he started traveling to New York, he gave it over to his cousin, Reb Michal Feinstein, the great Reb Michal Feinstein, later marries the Brisker Reb's daughter, Reb Moshe Feinstein's nephew, Reb Yechiel Miller. I went to see him when I came in Aliyah. I brought him greetings from the Rav. Reb Michal, it's the world gone by. Anyway, Reb Michal Feinstein, it didn't continue with him. Whatever the reasons were, the Rav was already in New York, World War II broke out, and Reb Michal joined his uncle Reb Moshe as a Rosh Yeshiva in Tiferet Yerushalayim. Then they said to him, "Nu, what was said to a guy named Yomo by a famous Chassidic Rebbe, nu." So he came back to Yerushalayim to marry the Brisker Rebbe's daughter. So that he had a part-time shtetl in Spring Valley. No, how much did it pay? When I was in the rabbinate, I always had two jobs. I left America. It wasn't the reason. The reason was the Six-Day War. But in 69 already, I had to make a choice because why you wanted me full-time plus, not just the Rebbe, but to teach American Jewish history. So a little in Stern College. Anyway, and the shtetl was growing. They wanted a full-time rabbi. But Kozman, the shteller is small, he worked as a fundraiser for Torah Vadas. That was a period where YU and Torah Vadas, you supported the yeshiva by Meshulachim. Today it's something you never heard of, Meshulach. I have a picture in my book of the last successful Meshulach from YU, Rabbi Avram Bender. Today his family wouldn't walk into YU. It's the famous Bender family. But that's the way they survived. So he became a fundraiser for Torah Vadas. As a fundraiser for Torah Vadas, he met some of the key people. First he met Rabbi Avraham Kalmanovich, the Mira Rosh Yeshiva, totally involved in Hatzalah work. And he assisted him. And here he tells a magnificent story on page 28. You have to have a background in modern Jewish history to understand this entirely. This involves the Russians. Stalin saw that he desperately needed American help. Stalin, like many other Gentiles of today, believed that the Jews control America. So Stalin figured if he can get the Jews to wake up in America, that put pressure on the government and give them more aid to the Soviet army, the Soviet economy, etc., etc. No, the Russian Jews, by the mid-1940s, early 1940s, who's left in Russia? So you had Yiddish speakers, the Moscow Jewish Theater, Shlomo Michael's, the director of the theater, the famous actor, the dibuk. This is a legendary figure. I could spend hours, but I don't have the time now. Reed Washington, who I talk about, the Shlomo Michael Center, dedicated in 1989, where I was present with Malka in Moscow. His daughter and granddaughter came from Israel. It was very moving. He's later exterminated by Stalin, hit by a car, was a killing by the KGB in Minsk on a winter night a number of years later. In addition to Shlomo Michael's, there's Yitzchak Pfeffer, who was one of the most famous Yiddish poets in the Soviet Union. So Stalin organized what was called the Anti-Fascist Committee, and the Anti-Fascist Committee sent Michael's and Pfeffer to visit America. to explain how wonderful the communist system is, how wonderful Stalin is, and it's well worth helping them. And everyone thought by their coming, it would have influence on Roosevelt, etc. Now, Rav Kalmanovich hears that they're coming. These were people totally irreligious. These were people who, to a certain degree, were communists. You know, you could be a communist and Stalin slaughtered you afterwards, but that's a different story. And Rabbi Kalmanovich goes to visit them, and he takes Baruch along, Nathan Baruch, and he describes the visit. And Rabbi Kalmanovich sees that these people perhaps can be of help as well with helping the Jews and the Jews in Siberia. And how do we get to them? How do we influence them? And there's one prominent Yiddish writer on the American scene, Shalom Esh. Heard the name? The Kiddush Hashem of 1648. All right, the Jewish world struggles with Shalom Esh until today because he wrote about the New Testament and wrote about Jesus. Did he believe in it? Didn't he believe in it? And Baruch goes with Kalmanovich to see Shalom Esh. He wants Shalom Esh, who's greatly admired by the communist world because he was himself somewhere between socialism and communism. And they go to see him. And Rav Kalmanovich says to Shalom Esh, he talks about Yehoram ben Achav. Look it up, Melachim Bet, Perik Vav, Pasuk 30, where Yehoram ben Achav, who was far from a tzaddik, a wicked king, the son of Achav, but when he heard that Jews were dying of starvation, he bared his chest, he ripped kriyah, he cried, and God gave him a schut. The idea being, he's saying to Shalom Esh, you may be a mishumad, but if you feel for your brethren, God will reward you. And they say to Shalom Esh, Jews are being butchered, Jews are being killed. And Shalom Esh says, Ich ken, I know. And Rav Kalmanovich starts crying and pleading with him, intervene with these people from Russia, maybe Stalin can help. And Kalmanovich was so powerful, Baruch describes, that Shalom Esh says to him, Rebbe, hot rachmanis, have pity on me. I know what's going on. You don't tell me anymore. It's too powerful. I can't handle it. And they never got to see. He said he would help. He tried to get hold of Michaels and Pfeffer, but the meeting never worked out. But this meeting had a great influence on Baruch, the Mesirat Nefesh he saw. And then Nathan Baruch describes the greatest influence in his life, Rav Aaron Cutler. And as a result of Rav Aaron, when he comes to America and all that goes on in the rejuvenation and the Var Hatzalah, and this Baruch winds up in Europe for 3 full years, basically, working in the camps, working with the survivors. He is the Var Hatzalah person on the ground. Everyone else visits, they're there for 3 months, 6 months, a year, but he is the permanent individual. And this volume, very fascinating, describes all that he did. And the final point on page 45, it's something we mentioned in class, it haunts someone like Rabbi Nathan Baruch, because he's an agudist, he's more right-wing. Why Rav Aaron Cutler didn't attend the march in 1943 in Washington. And let me tell you, Rakefet's not off base. Here's someone who knew Rav Aaron, was active, and the main reason he gives, what I told you, it has to be quiet diplomacy, shtatlanut, not to yell, not to cry, not to make public scenes, behind the door. Don't demonstrate. Don't make it front page news in the New York Times. And that was for Baron Shita, that was Agudat Yisrael Shita, that's the Shita that worked in the late 30s, and ultimately that played a big role in the Rav making up his mind once and for all, Lozu HaDerech, and leaving Reb Chaim Moshe's traditions, and Reb Chaim Moshe was a big influence on the Rav in this respect, leaving Reb Lezer Silva's traditions and becoming a Mizrachiite, B'lev V'Nefesh. There's one other sentence here, I'll end off with this, Baruch HaTot Noel HaMalch HaLam Shakon Yebet Baro. I listen to others and I hear them in the middle of the lecture also make a bracha. No, do you say amen? It's interesting. Sometimes I say amen like automatically and hear a bracha. But the truth is, it's not a bracha. It's made, you're listening to someone made the bracha a year ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, etc. All right, let it be. But that should be my worst problem.
I understand.
Now, there's one other sentence here which I don't understand, and I'm afraid this is already art scroll. You know, that whole, like, you can't face the truth. After he talks about the activism, he adds on, he also believed, yeah, furthermore, he feared his participation might overshadow the presence of the other rabbis, and he did not want this to happen. And he quotes someone telling him that. I don't understand what he's talking about. What do you mean, the presence of others? There were 400 rabbis there. We have a list. They were all the rabbanim, gedolim, rashi yeshiva, practicing rabbis, American-born rabbis, European rabbis. And also, I have to be honest, in 1943, Rav Aaron Kotler was not yet Rav Aaron Kotler. It's like the Rav coming to America. If someone's going to tell you that in 1932 everyone stood up for the Rav and Kale Pront to him, you don't know what you're talking about. Everyone stood up to him and slapped his face when they felt he was off base, incorrect. Remember with Birchat Kohanim what went on Yontif Shabbos in Boston. So I don't know what that sentence is about, but I'll only be Melamed Skutin says, Teretzvat the Baba. You know that expression? Mm-hmm. It's the answer you give your grandmother. All right. My dear students, I hope I have done justice to Bar Hatzala. I think the Lindingo sources brought it to life. And this was a great moment. We rose to the challenge as best we could. To me, it's very meaningful because of my involvement with Russian Jewry. And I can't forget sitting in the inner sanctuary in Tel Aviv on a street that no longer exists. It's part of Sarona today. If you've been there, it's worth seeing. When you see the sign, Albert Mendler, Po Haya Rechov, Albert Mendler, pause and think about it. So I remember the computer, the flashing lights, and all the names, the refusnikim, people wanting visas, 1980, this has to be 81. And look where we are as we approach 2019. The Russians owned the country. There was never a more successful aliyah than the Russian aliyah. Look at the Knesset. Look who's now taking over Misrad, what do they call it? Klitav, aliyah, a Russian, Elkin. Who's the chairman of the Knesset? Tomorrow there's a session on Hebron, because the leftists had a session last week where they had speakers say every Jew should leave Hebron, was the cause of all the problems. So tomorrow, Uri Kazin is speaking as representative of Hebron and others, organized by the speaker of the Knesset, Yuli Edelstein. Who's the most famous Jew alive that every Jew knows of? You mentioned Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein, how many heard of him? Mentioned Rav Shach, how many heard of him? But Anatoly Sharansky, who didn't hear of him? It's an unbelievable story. And it's a tremendous challenge to help bring them back totally to their people. All right, I've done my little share. I still try my best. God should help us. The freebies. I have some real... Here we are. My Talmud. You got to remember, I got a beautiful letter from Moshe Wiener. It was my Talmud in the 60s. Went a little bit more right than the Rebbe. He published the 1,000-page book. We've gone through a number of editions already. Why a Jew Has to Have a Beard. Here is a little booklet he just put out. Sent it to me with a beautiful letter about a shidduch. If the kala doesn't want you to have a beard, what should your attitude be? Very fascinating. Yitzchak, do me a favor. Give this letter to Michael Miller to give to Rabbi Bernstein. It's a thank you for the book he sent me.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Anyone see, anyone here from the Kollel? Where? No. All right, forget. Forget. Gentlemen, this is a little bit unbelievable. I think I told you in 1969, or 1968, let me see, yes, 1968. The Rav spoke at the Yudket Kislev Fabringen in Boston. That talk is online. I heard the talk years ago through illegal sources. It's a Meredith talk. Here is a summary of it that appeared in Hebrew, that appeared in Ma'ayanot of Chabad a number of years ago. It leaves out all the lumdus, but it's very, very nice. And this Taka captures the Rav, where the Rav breaks down and cries, I wish I had a Rebbe. I'm quoting the Rav. And he explains that when you go to a Rebbe and you unburden yourself, it takes away. It's like going to a psychologist a million times better. It's so insightful. So, unfortunately, I'm not a chassid, and I have a Rebbe. But I'm a Litvak. I had a Rebbe once in my life, and that's it. But I got to tell you, it's a beautiful document. I made copies. It's worth reading.
How many copies did you make?
And here you have a whole pile. I can make more. Here's an article. This is unbelievable what has surfaced. Know how many of you bless your children on Friday night? Do you bless them with two hands or one hand? So there's a whole theme that the Gaon only blessed with one hand, because only the Kohanim blessed with two hands. They now discovered a sefer. They have the text here. It's unbelievable. Of a good Jew who, before his bar mitzvah, came to the Gaon for a bracha. It was Shabbos, and the Gaon was eating kugel. And this little kid had a brand new shtreimel. It's before his wedding, I should say. And they bought him before you wear a shtreimel when you got married. The new who comes here from a Hasidic background. New Mark, when did you put on a shtreimel? When you got married. So the Gaon had grease on his hands from the kugel. So he only blessed the kid with one hand, not to get the shtreimel dirty. And boy, it's unbelievable. All the sources are there. Again, the Rebbe, true to form, this is Ben Sion Krasanovsky, Shaluach Chabad on the Upper East Side. He is completing 14 years of teaching the Tanya. It's online. Here's a picture that just surfaced. That's the Pitsetzner Rebbe, who he is the one that died in the Holocaust. This is the author of Chovat HaTalmidim. This is his nephew that I just mentioned earlier to you. That's the Pitsetzner Rebbe, very famous story. This is a website, Musings of a Litvish Yid, M-U-S-I-N-G-S. How do you pronounce it? Musings of a Litvish Yid. I know what the word means, but I never heard it used. And it's about what we're talking about Litvakin and having understanding of Hasidus. All right? Why use Hasidic revolution? A pioneer reflects. This is from the New York Times on the Catholic Church, not us. The terrible sexual scandals. When you read this, you shiver and shake. But then I think of what we have, and I can't, and I have to shiver and shake even more. Very fascinating articles. This is the Rebbe, true to form, Mr. Abraham Zygmunt, and he asked the Rebbe. He works on the Israeli radio. He'd like to leave and just seclude himself in a yeshiva, and the Rebbe tells him, remain in the radio where you're working. It's the Rebbe, true to form, be makarev, go back to the world you know best. And it's interesting what he talks about there, how the Rebbe gave him a whole $33 to give out to people who work in Kol Yisrael, and how Chiloniyim took the dollars and said, never get rid of it. It's from the Rebbe. Chiloniyim, very insightful, very interesting. Uncle on the last Jewish town in Azerbaijan. This was one very fascinating. The shul, the Jews, Hungary, lo aleinu, fighting going on today between the Chabad Rav and the head of the Jewish community over how to act with the Hungarian government and the right wing. And oh God, there's never an end to our fighting. Copies, New York Times, and Robert Alter has to be from the Chassidus Gerer Rebbe's family, a new version of the English of the Tanakh has just come out, and he worked on it for over 20 years.
What does this mean, a translation?
Translation, and you'll see what this
He's
talks about.
He's not known as a religious Jew.
No, but how do you translate Nefesh that you'll see, a very interesting article. America, the whole problem of the New York, the guidelines, secular education. Morty, I get this, that's the Nazir. They tell me that is Rav Kook. That is certainly not Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Kook. Could that be the Rav Kook that you know from Rehovot? Pass it back. Morty, this is for you, the article that goes on. Charlie, Mordechai Breyer, Eida V'dikt Yuna, Orthodoxia Yehudit B'Reich HaGermani, 1871 to 1918. Not him. Who is that? They say Rav Kook. Could that be his brother who was killed in the car crash?
I never saw a picture. I don't know. Charlie?
Yeah.
You know Rav Kook's
brother. Can you show it to Rav Kook and ask him who that is? He was killed much younger? No, that's the guy in uniform is the Rav Kook. Not the other one is the other one is the Nazir. The other one I recognize. I want to thank everyone for coming and honoring me with your presence. We should just have a Sora Tova Jeshuv Nechamot. Steve Bressler should have a Rafua Shlema. And I wouldn't miss next Sunday's class for all the rice in China. Which Rabbi Turk are we talking about? The question, the Gemara. If anyone can tell me one pshat in that Gemara that satisfies everyone, I'll dance a Kazaska Belin Neda right here in this classroom. I won't wait till I get to Red Square again. Until we meet again in health and happiness, Das Vedanya. Dov, I give you one objective. Try to figure out where Vic is, what has happened.
Okay,
no, I
one
didn't.
Second. He sent me an email. Oh. And he asked me to tell